You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 14th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we're taking a tech day, but still, all new content for you. How do we do it? I don't know. But we've done it again. First up, it'll be Joel Rubin from the Plowshares Fund to give us an update on the Iranian nuclear program negotiations and also to speak to us about the sequestration that will take place as a result of that debt ceiling limit deal, I should say. Now you know why I've taken the day off, folks. And just how much money we're spending on nukes. It's pretty stunning. And then members will have the opportunity to hear two interviews I did, one with Jesse LaGreca of Daily Kos and Occupy Wall Street, and Zach Walls. You remember that guy, that kid, basically, 18, 19-year-old kid who testified in front of the Iowa State Senate on behalf of marriage equality rights, author of the book My Two Moms, just an unbelievably impressive kid. And so definitely worth listening to that interview, if only to hear the resent that I have, that I've done nothing with my life relative to this kid. It's all ahead of him. And it's all ahead of you in just a moment. Remember, you can support the show by becoming a member at majority.fm. It is your support that will ensure that this show can continue. We have no corporate sponsors. 98.7% of our revenue comes from members. Oops, that's 98.6. Because, yes, it is trying times economically for people. And sometimes people write me and they say, I just can't afford to be a member anymore. I want to support your work. And with all those people, and I want to remind you, if you cannot afford to be a member and are very interested in listening to the extra bonus material that we provide our members every day, you can send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and we will work it out with you. We will turn no one away. But if you are in a position where you can support this show on a daily basis, please do. It allows the show to continue. It allows us to improve what we do. It improves the content, the quality of production sometimes. And it also allows the show to remain independent and not have to kiss the different asses that sometimes we feel it's necessary to kiss to keep other economic opportunities open. I'm not going to say any more. All right, here is Here's Joel Rubin from the Plowshares Fund. We are at Netroots Nation 2012 in Providence, Rhode Island, and with me is Joel Rubin from the Plowshares Fund. Joel, I want to talk to you. There's a couple of things I want to talk to you about, but first, give us an update. We've spoken in the past about the negotiations that are ongoing with Iran, essentially to resolve the disagreement we have that we believe they should have virtually no nuclear program. They want a civilian one. Where does that stand?
Thanks, Sam, for having me. Right now, the negotiations with Iran are in a difficult phase. The next steps are that the Western powers, the U.S., the European countries, the Chinese and the Russians, are going to meet with the Iranians in Moscow on June 18th and 19th. It'll be the third round of discussions. They're really focusing on the question of how much should Iran be able to enrich uranium. Should they be at the civilian levels, which is up to 3.5 to 5% of enriched uranium, or will they be allowed to go up higher to 20%? And it's not clear at all how these will come out. Right now, the Western powers are looking to cut a deal where they cap Iranian enrichment at a level that is at the civilian level and take the enriched fuel that is at 20%, which is more dangerous, out of the country. The Iranians are not yet clearly responding in a positive way. The Iranians, on the other hand, are asking for relief from sanctions and asking for confidence-building measures that they can take back home as well so we can move forward in the process.
What is the reason given by the Iranians as to why they're enriching this uranium to 20%?
The Iranians have been insisting that they have a civilian program, and that's why they have the enriched fuel up to the 5%, and they have about 5 tons of that. And then separately, they've enriched up to 20% uranium of about 140 kilograms, and they say that they're using that for power production for their nuclear research facility in Tehran. That's a research reactor that serves 800,000 cancer patients inside of Iran. So they convert that 20% fuel into uranium into fuel for the reactor. And they say that's transparent. The Western countries, on the other hand, say we need to know more. We don't fully believe you. We want to have the international inspectors go in whenever they need to see if that's really what you have at your disposal.
And sort of subtextual, that's also their way of saying, like, this may be a chit that we can cash in some level.
There's much of the bargaining is about the chits that each side has. There's a bigger picture issue going on between the West and Iran, and that's about the control of assets, of resources in the region, and really the power dynamics of the Middle East. The United States has been a large dominant power in the region for many years. Iran is trying to show that it too has strength. The Arab world is in revolt. So there's a lot of competition underway. At the same time, Israel is very concerned about Iran, and its nuclear program is very concerned that Iran may be using some of this enriched uranium to head towards building a nuclear weapon. You mash all this together, and you have a situation where we are looking at the most dangerous weapons on Earth, nuclear weapons, and trying to get at a deal with a country that has bigger interests than just nuclear weapons. So these negotiations are focusing on nuclear weapons. There's much more at play behind the scenes and signaling, and it's not at all clear how they'll turn out.
Since I believe these negotiations have begun, or maybe simultaneous, there was a report in the New York Times, I guess 2 weeks ago now, that a computer virus, Stuxnet, destroyed some of the enriching capacity of the Iranians. How does, and subsequent to that, it's quite clear that that came from us, and by us I mean the U.S. government.
Yes.
How does that impact the negotiations, A, and B,
Has there been in the you know, we know that the American government, the statutorily, if we were to be subjected to such an attack, it would be considered an act of war. I'm curious as to how this has impacted the negotiations.
We don't yet know what the Iranians will do in response to this, or how they'll react, or what they'll say at the next round of negotiations. But you're right in putting this on the table. It demonstrates that the Obama administration has tried to get at the Iranian nuclear program from a variety of angles. It's not new information that the Stuxnet virus hit the Iranian nuclear program, that it delayed and actually destroyed about 1,000 to 2,000 centrifuges in Iran. That was about 20% of their capacity. Those centrifuges are now more or less back online after a couple of years. But combining that with
it's new that we know now know almost an admission as to where from where it came.
Right, and there were always suspicions. Who did this?
Right.
Was it the Israelis? Was it the Americans? And now the New York Times has reported that it was a joint venture. There are a lot of legal questions about this. There's a lot of questions about what next in the cyber warfare. How does this impact U.S. interests? How does this impact our country's ability to use this technique in the future? But stepping back from it, the administration, by using the cyber worm, as reported, adding in strong sanctions and adding in now this layer of diplomacy, is going after the Iranian nuclear program with a variety of tools. What it isn't doing is starting a war, and what it isn't doing is actually invading or bombing or attacking sites inside of Iran. And they're demonstrating that they're taking it seriously, but I think it's pretty clear also that the administration is trying to do whatever it can to prevent a military outbreak.
Doesn't it create domestic pressure, I would imagine, on the Iranian regime? Almost less so that Stuxnet happened, and more so that it's clear where it came from.
It's a fascinating situation right now. The Iranians have said that they don't have a nuclear weapons program. They also have gotten their population on board with having a nuclear program. They're loath to talk about this inside Tehran. Once they start going down that road publicly in Tehran and saying that, yes, they were attacked, yes, their program has been in violation of certain commitments and against UN resolutions, it opens up a Pandora's box of questions about its legitimacy. It's very dicey for them also to talk about it.
All right. Well, we need to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about how our nuclear arsenal is playing into the defense budget, and how this is going to play out in regards to the supposed to happen sequestration of 500, I believe it is, billion over the next 10 years. We'll be right back. We're talking to Joel Rubin from the Plowshare Fund. We are back from Netroots Nation 2012 in Providence, Rhode Island. I have the opportunity to sit down with Joel Rubin of the Plowshare Fund. We were talking, Joel, in the last segment about the Iranian nuclear arsenal, or would-be arsenal, I guess, is more appropriately. And let's talk about the American arsenal and the implications for how much money we're spending on this stuff, why, and is any of it going to get cut if there, in fact, is the $500 billion automatic cut over 10 years that's supposed to take place in the fall, which nobody seems to think is actually going to happen. But let's start with, we spend a lot of money on nukes, don't we?
We spend $70 billion a year on nuclear weapons and related programs.
$70 billion. And how much of a drop-off is that since the fall of the Soviet Union?
It's not really much, if any at all. A study was just concluded earlier this week by the Stimson Center, a nonpartisan think tank in Washington, identifying that number, $700 billion over the next decade, is what the U.S. will spend for nuclear weapons and related programs, including missile defense. That is a significant sum of money, and it is Cold War spending. These are levels, and these are weapons that are oriented towards past threats. And at this stage, The president himself, who's trying to reduce the number of nuclear weapons, is fighting an entrenched bureaucracy, a defense contractor bureaucracy, members of Congress who want to keep their pork in their districts, and is really trying to fight against this level of spending. Right now, with so much on the table, social programs, domestic programs, and other defense programs that are key to protecting our troops, all of those are being looked at with scrutiny. The nuclear weapons budget, however, is somewhat protected, and so it's really key that policymakers begin to deal with this.
Now, if I remember correctly, the reason why we had so many nukes was because it was going to be a deterrent, right, from Russia using all of their nukes, or I should say the Soviet Union. What is the rationale for having the same capacity now? Like, who is it that we are supposedly intimidating? Who are we staving off some type of alien invasion because they know that we have all these nukes now that we don't need them for we could.
The irony is that we are still living off of the strategic doctrine of the Cold War. The president has on his desk an opportunity to shift the way our policy is on targeting. The targeting that the U.S. Defense Department has had to drive its nuclear weapons acquisition was oriented towards targeting Soviet cities. That is still the case. So we need to shift away from that, and the president can begin to do that, but only then does the bureaucracy begin to cut down on the number of nukes.
It's taken. We're 20 years out now.
That's right.
From the fall of the Soviet Union.
That's right.
How is it? I don't understand. This is almost sort of mind-boggling. I mean, I can understand that people don't like to talk about the official change in the doctrine, to change the direction of a ship, you know, as it were, the size of America. But the idea that we're all these weapons are still pointed in the same place they were 30 years ago, I don't understand. Hasn't anybody... Is anybody in our government awake?
Well, the president is awake and his team is awake, and they're working intensively to try to shift the way this bureaucracy works. But we have a bureaucracy dedicated to nuclear weapons built up from the 50s forward that has over time created redundant layers upon redundant layers upon redundant layers of nuclear weapons systems that will protect against any inevitability at any level. We have a triad, it's known as, of bombers, subs, and missiles that are redundant in their use. We could bomb the Soviet Union 20 times, 50 times over back in the Cold War, and we can still do that today. We have subs, nuclear subs, currently that carry 160 warheads. So we have to scale back. But until we change the strategy, the actual number of nuclear weapons is always going to be at a very high level. And that strategy document is being debated in the White House. But the president faces serious resistance.
I just don't understand how it's only being debated now. What have they been doing for the past 20 years?
They've been relying on the Cold War theory.
Has the bureaucracy not felt that they need to actually, at the very least, institute some type of new doctrine to justify themselves? I mean, are they so entrenched that they don't even feel like they need to protect themselves from the notion of a new strategic doctrine?
I'll give you an example. About a year and a half ago, the Senate passed the New START Treaty. That was the treaty with Russia to reduce the number of deployed strategic nuclear warheads to 1,550. Mind you, that's about a third of what we have deployed. But to reduce that was a severely difficult political fight for the president. And just this past month, the House Armed Services Committee and then the entire House passed a bill that opposed any further reductions in the New START Treaty and in nuclear weapons until the president could lard on more funding for nuclear pet projects around the country. There is a deep political resistance, primarily amongst Republicans, to reductions in nuclear weapons, and the president and Democrats have been fighting on this, and they took a lot of heat for the New START Treaty.
So the attempt is essentially to re-strategize as to where these missiles are pointed and then work backwards from there and say, hey, you know, we have a bunch of leftover missiles. I guess we can get rid of those, right?
That's right. And the good thing is that work has been done on the outside. General James Cartwright, who was the number two general advising the president over the past several years, is now on the outside of government. And he released a report supported by Global Zero that found that we could have 450 nuclear weapons with another 450 in storage and be fine. So cut the force significantly, no problem. people are thinking about it and talking about it, but the bureaucratic resistance and the political resistance is high.
We just have another minute. Who is there anybody in the legislative branch that is championing this issue that we should be paying attention to, or are they just? Is there no value in any of them?
There are some very good leaders on this. Dick Lugar, who lost in his primary battle, was the historic champion of arms control in the Senate. John Kerry led the fight to get the New START agreement through. Dianne Feinstein is leading the fight to reduce spending and be more fiscally prudent. Ed Markey in the House has led the fight as well to try to cut the nuclear weapons budget. There are champions, and there's real energy behind them. That said, the forces of status quo are very strong on this issue.
Does the pressure of the sequestration, does that help at all?
What the sequester is doing is it's opening up a discussion about what the defense priorities of the country are. And what we'll argue, and what we do argue, is that at this stage in our country's history, we can't afford to be wasting tens of billions of dollars on outdated Cold War systems. We need to save that money for other programs, be it in defense or elsewhere, and that's the debate we're having right now in Washington.
Joel Rubin of the Plowshare Fund, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
All right, folks, that is our program today. If you, of course, if you support this program, stick around. We still have interviews with Jesse LaGreca and Zach Walls. We'll be back live Friday, as always, hopefully with Cliff Schechter and our movie recommendation guest, as well as more stories, your phone calls, your IMs, etc., etc., etc. Again, don't forget, ensure that this show continues by becoming a member, supporter, whatever you want to call it, today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, delicious, arguably good for you. I'm no doctor. I did play a doctor, actually, in a pilot. It was a comedy pilot. You didn't miss anything if you didn't see it. But it's good for economic justice. Fair trade, that means everybody gets paid what they're worth. Nobody gets screwed. And you get a 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. Get the Majority Report blend. Why not? JustCoffee.coop. Also, leave us an iTunes review. Come on. Seriously? I can't even count the thousands of you who have not. No excuse for that. If you buy your crap on Amazon and you're not buying it through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show, you can see the link there, then you are doing both of us a disservice. Best way to feel righteous about your rampant consumerism is to buy it through our Amazon link if you buy crap through Amazon and give us a kickback. Of course, we have Majority Report merchandise, swag, donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Impress your friends with all the incredible, in-depth, educational, if you will, political content. All right, see you Monday. Stick around for Jesse LaGreca and Zach Walls.